This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode has been recorded December 21st, 2011, and tonight we are talking to Chris Williams and Matthew Podwasaki. We're catching back up with Chris and Matt after last speaking to them in, I guess it was May of 2010, and that was after, let me see, I'm checking.
It was just after the last JSConf.
Exactly, yeah. So we wanted to catch up with you on a few things. One thing that Matt was recommending was that we catch up both on community JS and then how that kind of flowed into more discussion this year. So can you give us the idea behind the community JS talk that you gave last time around?
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, everybody. Just in case you don't know who I am, I'm Chris Williams. My wife and I, we curate JSConf, which is a conference devoted to JavaScript, for better or for worse. And last year, in depending upon when this goes out, let's specify, 2010, in the European edition of JSConf held in Berlin, I gave a presentation about how we need to sort of change the world by changing everything, fixing our own problems in our own inherent community. We launched the Promote JS campaign, which was sort of a driving force to help new people and people who have used JavaScript to get access to the right information by essentially Google bombing the proper information up to the right places. And at this point, we can happily say that was quite successful. Every single term that we had targeted is on the first page, if not in the top five placement of search results. So hooray. Hooray. Now when you go and search for like JavaScript array, you'll actually get the right documentation. You won't get something that was written in the 1980s before JavaScript was made. But hey, it's finally taken us this long to get to that point. Part of it was also a damn the privateers, love the pirate call, which was to sort of not really address anything specific that was happening at the moment, but to take a look at the world where JavaScript was heading, JSConf, as well as jQuery, jQueryConf, the wonderful people at jQuery, everyone all around has been doing a good job of getting JavaScript the exposure that, for better or worse, it sort of deserves and necessitates in the modern world. So I wanted to address some of the things that I saw that could happen to the new community. In 2010, Node was on a meteoric rise and arguably still is. CoffeeScript was just in the beginning of its infancy. And I wanted to say, look, everybody, don't forget where we've been. Don't forget who we are. Most people who were in JavaScript between 2010 and now, they were probably writing PHP, .NET, C#. I can just rattle off everything. And if you think back in your own experiences, you probably didn't wake up and go, I'm a painter, but now I'm going to be a JavaScript developer. Yeah, that's amazing. You probably started out with a different discipline, different language, and then JavaScript was a necessary evil. And much like that for almost every single language that I think developers run into, we always seem to get so shiny new toyish with the next language, and we should all just come to a realization that all languages, for all their faults, for all their benefits, are just ways to write machine code. They're all doing the same thing. If you prefer a certain way, great. If I prefer a different way, great. We don't need to have long battles about it. And we should avoid people who try to encourage or instigate that, especially for commercial profit and gain. That sort of flows into what I presented this year at JSConf.eu. I never get to present at my own U.S. version of the conference, so I take advantage of the times that I'm allowed to speak at JSConf.eu.
Is that just because you're so busy organizing things that you just can't speak as well?
Sort of. And, it kind of feels odd if the guy who's running the conference, oh, he got a speaking slot. Of course he got a speaking slot. He picked the slots. It feels odd for me if I'm running the conference and picking speakers and also speaking. It's a personal thing. Running the conference is very stressful, and I wouldn't want to give a non-great performance. So, yeah, there is that aspect of it. But the main thing is I don't want to be granted in a spot just because I'm the guy running it type thing. So at EU, the Germans all run it, and I have to go through the same grilling process as everyone else. In fact, they grill me a little bit harder on my presentations because, you know, I'm a bit of a crazy guy. So this year's, they put me at the keynote slot again, which I need to stop them from doing that, and gave a presentation about something that had sort of gotten to me from JSConf US 2011, which we held out in Portland. Fallout from that, fallout from different events, and just sort of looking at the world as it is. And I mean, if you go onto Hacker News right now, I can promise you, whenever you're watching this, I can promise you, click on any link, go to the comments, and I can promise you'll see this played out. We have a epidemic problem, a systemic problem, arguably, in the developer community that negativity is so high and so rampant that it's almost feeding itself at this point, and exponentially growing at this point. You look at any of the major news outlets, and it just seems to grow. And what I've seen happen is, you know, good people, good, honest people who are trying to get by, who are believing that, you know, polyglots are better than single language, hoo-ha, hooray. Everyone has a tendency to, if you get scarred or you get mocked or you get made fun of, to instantly, or maybe not even instantly, maybe a couple weeks later, maybe a couple months later, maybe even a year later, backlash against somebody else trying to do something new, sort of like taking it out on them. And I've run across this a couple times, and I've actually called out or asked a couple of people who were doing this, and they, you know, I didn't call them out in public. I talked to them independently and said, hey, what's going on? And to get to the realization that it's feeding itself. If I'm negative to you, you have a tendency to go be negative to someone else because for whatever reason, the thread got too long or too much flame, or I don't want to go down in flames or whatever. Whatever reason it ends up being diverted elsewhere. And we need to come to the realization that we need to stop doing that. And we also need to stop, as you can see in any of the numerous examples, the latest ones were the Lamer News, use bcrypt tirade that happened. You can see it in any of the CoffeeScript posts. Every day there's one for or against CoffeeScript. Right.
You know, issue 28.
There is the people who go into battle either to show that this other way is right, or that their way is righter than the existing way or the incumbent way. And then there's a whole gaggle of people that just jump on, that aren't actually involved in the fight. They have no skin in the fight. They have no real reason to be in the fight. They just want to get the, haha, yeah, that too. Or the plus one-ing, as I like to call it. They don't actually have any argument or reason. They just are there to cheer the jabs. And so I wanted to try to make a stand and say, look, we need to stop cheering the jabs. We need to stop making jabs. We need to understand that every single time we're negative about a new idea, we're actually killing the potential of that new idea. And as a culture that's built around risk, a lot of people who are developers have the means and ability to take something, take an idea, an idea that's not even anything in the real realm of possibility, and convert it into something realistic, real, whole, created, birthed, deployed out to a server, and now scalable to millions in the cloud. I had to put in the cloud there. It's just a thing. You know, that talent, that ability, that means of production is unattainable and unthinkable for almost every single other profession. Architects can't do it. Construction engineers can't do it. Painters can't do it in the time frame and complexity that a developer can. And every time we go and we make fun of a fellow developer for a crazy idea that they have, we are at some level saying, hey, don't be crazy, stay within the bounds. Even though there are no real metaphysical, physical, or logical bounds that we are actually confined to. So it concerns me that we're in an environment that is creative, that it doesn't have the historical boundaries or preventions or timelines that you know every other industry has. We live in a world where startups are encouraged and people are encouraged to take risk. And then our buddies who write code are the ones who are bringing us down. It's not even business guys anymore. It's not business guys saying, no, that's a dumb idea. They're saying, hey, how can I make money off of that idea? Which is crazy, but you know, it's actual developers who are bringing down other developers. It's like dev on dev hate, and I don't think that's right. And what sucks is also the other side of this, and I'm sure we've all experienced this, when when you feel that burn, that hate, that just blind retweeting or blind plus wanting, when you feel that come your way, the only thing your friends do is tell you, don't worry about it, haters gonna hate. And I think we need to stop that. I think we need to stop blaming the victim, blaming the person who that hate is going against, and start blaming the people who are causing it. And so as best as I can, because I'm just one person, I'm trying to, wherever I see these battles, either say, look, you two are having it out, go talk about this. It's cathartic, it's therapeutic for you two to talk about this, but doing it in a public forum is very messy. It's sort of a term that I made called kids in the back, because as parents, especially now me actually having a child, I'm learning this very quickly. When your child sees you and your spouse or significant other fight, they learn that pattern. They learn that process. They learn that fighting is good, and it really isn't. So when you say kids in the back, or you throw kids in the back on Twitter, the two people who are fighting, it should be just a call to action. Say, okay, let's just take this offline. Let's call each other up. Let's talk over email. Let's do something that's directed one-to-one, not so everyone else can jump in and plus one. I made the argument that you should self-correct, or you should self-identify that after three comments in a thread. But when you're in a heated thread, you're not going to recognize that. So as best as I can, I try to say, hey, take this offline, kids in the back, go. I also sort of encourage people to not get into battles anymore. If you have a disagreement, open source is great. The ones about CoffeeScript, the one today is about implicit scoping, how it's the worst thing ever since JavaScript was invented. You know, CoffeeScript is a beautiful thing for people who like CoffeeScript. JavaScript is a beautiful thing for people who write JavaScript. Why we have to force one on the other doesn't make any sense. If you don't like the way CoffeeScript does it, make MochaScript, which would be a fork that has your sort of pieces that you like. If enough people like it, it'll get adopted. If they don't, well, you got a cool new language all to your own. That's the beauty of open source. That was the intention of forking. That's the reason why it's great. But we don't seem to embrace that. We seem to be wanting to let someone else, you know, write scathing blog posts espousing how much better we are, the individual, at the downside of another.
And how other technologies are cancer, yes.
Right. Specifically with that, Armin's a great guy, and Jeremy's a great guy, and they both have great perspectives. I just think that it's not them in the battle, it's our general mentality that we feel compelled to write these things, and we shouldn't always go for the blog post. We should say, hey, let me just fork it, and you know, if it takes off, great, even better.
So while I applaud your effort and I support it, I don't think that the problem is limited to the developer community and or even the technical community. I think it's just the world in general now.
Okay, you can't just say fix the world in general. We're working on that later, actually.
Yeah, so I'm just saying it's going to make the job even tougher because, you know, you not only have, especially in an election year, for God's sake, you not only have, you know, this stuff happening on the internet, which is for eons, since the beginning of the dawn of time, has been known for, you know, trolls and Usenet and just a vast pit of poison. So you not only have that working against you, but then you have the constant barrage of snark media and political ads and newspapers, and it's really exactly what Louis C.K. said. You know, everything is amazing and it all sucks. That just seems to be the attitude that everyone has towards everything now, and it's kind of old. I don't know how we fight back other than trying to be somewhat positive, but at the same time, people, for some reason, especially 5 or 6 years, or maybe since Bush won, I think, really, they felt this need to polarize no matter what. So if I point to something and I say, I disagree with that viewpoint, then someone will come back and say, well, you're an idiot, rather than saying, have you considered, you know, X, Y, or Z? They just tell me that, you know, I'm an idiot, or you don't know, or why are you doing this? And I'm just, you know, I'm really confused by, you know, how this has taken off and how to fight back against it.
Well, I think fighting back is sort of a thing that you can't really fight back. It's like going to war for peace. It doesn't make any sense. You can't go to battle for peace, even though we try to. Or you gotta you got to make local changes. You got to change yourself before you can go try to change the world. I made that speech, but I'm as guilty as everyone else. It's like you had mentioned, it's sort of the modern society, but it doesn't mean that tomorrow morning you can't wake up and, you know, when you see a battle going on, avoid the urge to add into it. Or when you see somebody coming at you, avoid the urge to go back and say, hey, I see that. Did you have an issue? You want to go get a beer? And we'll chat about it. And that always works. Nobody's ever been offered a beer and said, no, I don't want a beer. It's the only, I would contend that's the way to fight back, is just to offer beer.
Yeah, I mean, nothing really beats the face-to-face aspect of it. I mean, it's so easy to lob bombs when you're hiding behind a handle that isn't even your name. Than it is to actually put your face out there and really put your soul on the line. It's really something a lot different.
That's not really possible in a lot of cases, right? I mean, it's all
no, it's not
distributed stuff. So like,
it doesn't scale very well. No,
wait, what's not possible?
Well, a lot of times you're not dealing with people who you can get together and have a beer with. You know, they're on the other side of the world.
No, yeah, I mean, it is tough, but it's more just making that. If somebody is in a position that you could offer to. I got into a recent one with somebody who's in San Francisco. I'm out of D.C. And we didn't go get a beer immediately. What we had said is, hey, next time we're in the same spot, we should grab a beer. We should continue the conversation then. And that, I mean, you don't have to have the beer immediately in the heat of passion. You just have to have the cognition to say, this might be an issue that's deeper that we need to talk about, and probably not on a public channel.
I see what you're saying there with it's the personal, it's bringing things from arguing in a public forum to a personal discussion. And I can't think of an instance where I talked to somebody and came away with just, well, they're just evil. They're just, you know, everybody, yeah. When you talk to them, is reasonable and they have reasons. And a lot of the time they go back to things that it's like, well, I hate this technology because I worked on a project and my lead sucked and he loved that technology and blah, blah, blah. And it has, you know, it's an association. It's not always a direct thing, you know, and you wouldn't know that until you discuss it directly and find out what's going on.
Right, which is scary. I mean, if you look at all the Node being one of the big ones right now, that takes a lot of heat. And I'm by no means saying Node's the greatest thing. It's just another thing. It's the thing of the current target, as it were. If you look at some of the ones that the arguments there, the main core argument that everyone has about it is that it's JavaScript, which is exactly like you said. They had one bad experience in college with JavaScript and they're never going to try it again. And no matter what Node does or whatever, you know, whatever CoffeeScript does, they don't care because it has that word JavaScript with it. And they tried it once and they didn't get it. So they just hate it. And you see that with every language, and it sort of sucks that dominates the stream, that somebody didn't want to actually take the time to learn the language, attempted it, failed, and just went forward in life hating it. So like people like that, I always try to reach out to them direct and say, hey, I know you hate JavaScript. If you want, I'd be more than happy to just talk about it with you. If it still sucks, cool, not a big deal. I'd love to know what you're getting into, because you always find, especially when you put out the hand, like, what are you doing that's so much more cool? It always seems to come around and you potentially either learn something or you make a good friend out of it, which is neither of which are bad things.
So I think, too, that, I mean, having watched some of your recent talks in preparation, I think about, like, you start out by saying, look, I'm not necessarily the best at this. And you've said that already as we're talking now, you know, and I think just coming out immediately and being a little disarming in that way, because I think especially in online forums and as programmers, we're so belligerent, you know, naturally. And I think that what you're doing there is a great first step of, you know, starting out with disarming.
Well, humility is a good thing. I wish we encouraged it more in individuals, probably more than we do. We seem to, and this was sort of going back to 2010. I hate the terms that you see thrown around, like ninjas and rock stars and stuff like that, because really what that is self-promotion. That's pimping me at somebody else's downfall. You know, when I go to hire individuals, the first thing that I look for is, are they humble? I'll assume they have good technical chops, otherwise they wouldn't have signed up. I want to see somebody who can say, you know what, I have this great idea, but you think your idea is great too. Let me see your great idea, and it might make my idea even greater. And then combined, we'll both have investment in it, and we'll both make it wonderful. Those are your great people, especially to work with. Those are always the best. And like you said, it is very disarming. If somebody comes up to you and says, you know, your idea is amazing, I think it's great. If you just added this, it'd be wonderful, and everyone would love it. That's a lot easier to take than your thing sucks, mine's so much better because I added this one little thing. It's a huge level of difference between the two.
So do you think, I mean, part of this we talked about, there's the community discussion forums we have now. You think of like Hacker News and Reddit and, you know, different kind of, those areas tend to be, it's all voting up or down, and it's fail or win. And so it depends button, or this is a good idea with some, you know, with some caveats or whatever. It's always win and lose. You know what I mean? So that seems like a really difficult problem there, the online discussion, other than people just keeping this in mind and trying to be positive. And, you know, I understand you're encouraging that and speaking at conferences, but is there anything we can do in online discussions to fix this?
That's a good question. I mean, as you've just described, the systems as they are set up right now are designed to encourage negativity and debate and thrashing and all these other horrible or lead to horrible things. I mean, if everything was great, you would never have a downvote button. You would always have upvote, and you would never have negative comments. You would have like six options, and the options would be cool, cooler, coolest, OMG, so cool, and then continuing on up the scale. There would never be the option for negativity, but that isn't really the world we live in. People want to give advice, and when you look at all the negative comments, there are grains of truth in it. Not to keep talking about Node, but you could sub in Ruby on Rails, you could sub in PHP, you could sub in Perl, you could sub in Assembly for this next statement. When it starts in its infancy, everyone says it can't do X. And you know what ends up happening is it ends up being able to do X because everyone says it can't do X. If there was only a better way that we could find a way to get everyone to say, this one piece, you should think about adding, just because other things have it and it's a good thing, as opposed to this sucks because it can't do factorial as fast as some other people theoretically can. Those sorts of arguments are mundane and trite and don't make sense because software isn't made in stone. It's constantly moving and it's constantly changing.
Well, so speaking about some of the communities, of course, you know, the Reddit and the Hacker News are kind of known for negativity, but I've always been amazed at the Stack Exchange, the gallery of communities, and how, I mean, 90% of the time when you go and you read a Stack Exchange answer question, like on Stack Overflow or something, it seems to be not necessarily neutral, but more positive than negative, at least in the comments. And I don't know if that's just because the moderators are doing a good job of hiding it all, or if the community really is self-correcting in that case.
I wish I would believe that it's self-correcting, but I fear it's a combination of things. I don't think it has the mass to drive, to bring in the, if you look at it, the people being negative are maybe 5% of the population. And as long as Hacker News and Reddit and all these other ones are full of them, they're not in anything else. If you go look at Slashdot now, Slashdot's great because nobody's on it. not in a negative way, but none of the bad elements are present, or at least they're not always there answering, putting in their two cents into everything. They have a lot of two cents, and I don't get where they get all this money from. I think Stack Overflow will get to that point, especially once the negative elements realize that a lot of companies are now using Stack Overflow as recruiting grounds. So it's just yet another place to say, I'm so much better than this other Joe Schmo. You should look at me. I'm awesome. And once that happens, it's a slippery slope. And until we correct the fundamental thing and, you know, get people to not be as so on guard and, you know, be willing to take the first arrow and instead of throwing back, be like, hey, why don't we chat about this somewhere else? I think once we stop that, it starts getting better.
I think, too, some of it is that Stack Overflow is very, like, it's not immediately obvious, but it's very much engineered towards promoting behaviors and discouraging other behaviors. And so there is moderation, but there's also just a lot of, like, if you're constantly downvoting, you lose points when you downvote, you know, and things like that. And so and if you lose enough points, you lose privileges. And if you gain points, you gain privileges. And so there's an encouragement towards positivity and also towards solving a problem. And I think Stack Overflow at the heart of it is geared towards answering questions, to answer a question, like, the code actually has to work. I was working with somebody else today, and I saw a solution on Stack Overflow and it had 24 upvotes, and I was like, let's try this. And the guy was like, well, how do you know it's going to work? I'm like, because, like,
how do you know any code works?
That's definitely true. But I mean, it's kind of self-correcting in that if the code doesn't work, the code speaks for itself, you know? And right. So if somebody posts, you know, really hip, cool code, but it doesn't work, that problem gets corrected. You know, whereas if somebody has an opinion on Hacker News, an opinion is not as self-correcting as, does this code actually perform as you say it will, or solve this problem, or that kind of thing.
Yeah, and in isolation, that works. The problem that I've seen with Stack Exchange, Stack Overflow, that variety, is that it spawns over or spreads over into other channels. So if you take any of the questions and you jump over to Twitter and rub up against them, you'll notice that maybe some of those questions are posed in a way that are just used as fodder for making fun of either the people who posted or responded. Mm-hmm. So there is some of that underbelly present, especially if you look at it from a different lens. The base element of searching it and finding an answer, it makes sense for now. But, I mean, I see elements of the darker variety creeping in.
So there were two sides to your recent talk, and one, on the end to negativity. And one was on, you know, actively working against negativity. But another side of it is the positive side. Promote JavaScript, fork, and create. I mean, and the whole idea of creating being a positive thing in and of itself, it pushes things forward. But also, when you're actively creating, it's a lot harder for me to be negative when I'm putting myself out and creating things. Because when you're creating, right, you make mistakes and you're immediately more vulnerable, and you're a lot less, it's a lot harder to, like, just randomly tell people they're idiots when you, I just pushed a bad build yesterday, or, you know, I mean, so.
Well, not even that, but, like, where do they find the time to do this? I consider myself a pretty active user in the world, and I never have time to write a long diatribe, more than 5 words or something, before I get called into duty of doing something else, or I'm like, hey, I just want to spend time with the real human beings in the actual world. I'm not sure how... I've talked to some people about this, actually. If you look at a lot of the people who throw the negative comments in there, there is a correlation between number of open source projects or number of visible projects, or lack thereof, and their volume or velocity of negative comments. It's almost making up for a lack of something, but I'm not going to say what that something is. It's the number of projects. I just said it, so that way I was just going to clear up anything in case anyone was wondering.
I think it also correlates to the number of wives and the number of kids.
More wives, kids, less time, or exactly. More wives, kids, more negativity?
Both.
Could go both ways. It's a battle. So I would just say, if you want to end negativity, if you don't want to be negative, do something. Go out, make something. Start using a new language. You'll think differently, and you'll feel better about yourself, and life will be happy.
You know, I think as part of, even if you feel negatively about something, the right response, like, you could just say this sucks and write long comments, or you could, like, I saw an interesting post recently from Rob Connery, and he saw something, he saw a project that was interesting, but their video sucked, in his opinion. So what he did was he recut the video and put in call outs and spoke over it and did all, and kind of professionally produced. He made the video so nice. If I was that project owner, I would have just taken that video and put it on my site. You know, it was great. And he said, these are some, you know, this is a great project. Here's how this screencast could be that much better. And obviously forking a project and contributing code is that, you know, it's that much more natural.
Yeah, I think that Chris is absolutely right, that you become very, very vulnerable out there as soon as you start putting your work out there. And nowadays, it seems with the Hacker News cycle, with the Reddits and so forth, that the internet really never sleeps, and things take on a new life of their own, and it's really hard for someone to get started and to just really throw themselves out there and get that really positive feedback. It's really hard because you've got a lot of that negative energy going on there that in turn that you kind of feel either you should lash out at somebody else or you just curl up into a ball and never ever really want to contribute again. And it's really hard to say I'm going to be positive about this unless there's a more fundamental change in the way we do things as a developer community.
I also want to make just a note on that it's not just new things. It's not just people taking risks with new things. Maybe conferences are a unique discipline, but one of the things that Laura, my wife, and I deal with every single time we do a JS Conf is after the conference, we're sort of like, we don't want to deal with any of this crap ever again. There's so much, such a high prevalence of negativity. The conference could be absolutely amazing, and we give it our all. It could be the best conference ever, but if somebody, you know, stepped on a piece of gum outside the meeting space, they'll tweet about it and be like, this conference sucked because there was gum outside. Well, nobody ate gum and like stuck it there just to screw you. It's just life. Just deal with it. But the problem is that the trajectory of negativity is so high. We had a very unique experience, and I don't really like bringing it back up, but we had an issue at JSConf US 2011 with gender. We had actually two issues. One was a very positive issue that the conference itself was able to raise $3,137. It was over $3,000 that we were able to donate back to an outreach program that went, you know, took college age computer science individuals out into areas that may not have encouragement in the computer sciences, and specifically in gender and racial diversity, diverse areas, to try to get people different than your standard attendee at a JSConf, or different than your standard attendee at a RubyConf or a PyCon, to come to come to computer science. And then once you do that, go all the way up through, because the problem we have in America specifically, especially with gender, is there are less women going into computers in high school, which means that there's a smaller pool going into college, which means there's a smaller pool going into the workforce, which means there's an even smaller pool going into conferences. So if your concern is increasing gender diversity at conferences, solving it by trying to get more women at a conference isn't really solving the problem. It's trying to just put a Band-Aid on the current situation or solve for symptoms. The problem is inherent in the entire workflow. If we don't fix the upstream problem, we're just going to be getting worse and worse. So we made a big effort to try to fix and make aware of the upstream problem by increasing the diversity coming into computing sciences early. That's a great thing. I would like to ask if you guys would take a guess as to how much public tweeting or Facebooking or whatever social networking we had from that. I won't hold you in suspense. It's a round number, around zero. There was no publication of it, and it's kind of disparaging. It's a positive thing that people, you know, they'll applaud and they're like, whatever, I don't care. Even though it
if I recall, there was quite a bit of negativity.
The negativity happened at lunch. There was an unfortunate incident that happened on stage that we as the organizers took care of immediately, apologized for the situation, and made sure that the individuals responsible were not allowed back up on stage.
Well, I thought there was some negativity around the actual donation.
Oh, there was that too. No good deed goes unstoned. that we didn't give it to the right places, that it wasn't enough. We did a whole drive leading up to there was all sorts of just disgustingness about it. So those two are great examples that, you know, the lunchtime one, it was all over the internet by a whole bunch of people who were not at the conference. I think there were five people who were at the conference that made it known that it was an issue, and we handled it immediately. And it didn't matter. Once it gets to the internet, the warped sense of the internet goes crazy. And by the time we got home from Portland, I could tell you that people think that my wife and I, and I'll say that again, my wife and I are the most sexist conference organizers out there. I don't know how that's possible, but hey, I'm going to keep going with the way it is. But it just goes to show that an established brand, an established event like JSConf, it's not impervious to these sorts of negativity. Anytime you do anything for any period of time, you're putting yourself out there. It takes a lot of effort, arguably more effort, to keep pushing something even past that initial backlash and to keep going and going and going, because you're going to keep getting the things that give you the backlash, and you're going to have these, you know, reconsideration points. If you're at one of those and you're listening to this, screw the negativity, find a good buddy, let them handle all the negativity, just let them take the side for you. I know it's hard to do. I don't do it myself, but don't look at the media streams and just keep doing amazing things. You got a friend in at least me, and I'll stand by you. So if you need any help, reach out to me, and more than happy to help out with that.
You know, I think so. I've been recently teaching my daughter how to program a little bit, and she's done some basic JavaScript, and I've taught her, you know, HTML, and we've had fun playing with the developer tools and going in, and I let her paint my blog pink, and she thought that was great. And, you know, but but I'm going with, as I'm watching her learn how to code, I'm thinking back to, like, nobody gets into programming as a way to be better than somebody else or a way to belittle somebody or any of that. It's about the joy. It's about creating, and it's about the fun of, like, making something and building something. And so I keep thinking, like, we got to keep coming back to that. And people keep going off track, and they're going to do that. And some people can be easily convinced and some can't, but it's got to be about just, like, continually coming back to the joy and the fun and the building side of things, you know?
100% agree. That actually brings to mind a crazy thing that if you're listening to this and you're a male, and you have children, especially if you have daughters, come Father's Day, ask your daughter to instead of a gift or a trinket or anything of that nature, or a tie as is the normal thing to give, ask them to spend 20 minutes, maybe 2 hours, whatever you can spare, with them, to let them learn how to program. If every single male in the development population who had a daughter went and said, hey, for Father's Day, one day, we're going to have an awesome experience. We're going to make a web page, like you just said, paint the blog or change the blog to pink. That is a lasting image. And children are very impressionable, as we all know, and a lasting image of their father or mother, could be mother too, I don't want to dissuade against women, could be father or mother, whoever, you know, teach your children, take the time to create a shared experience with them. That lasts forever. The only reason why I'm in this is because my father took the time to teach me how to take apart a computer and how to hack a BBS system. It sounds like probably everyone on the call would probably be similar, had some shared experience that... Yep. With a computer that made them think, you know, I might be able to do this. This could be cool. If we did that, we would not have a gender issue. There would not be an imbalance. In part because it's roughly 51% female, when you procreate on a large statistical aggregate. So therefore, you know, if every single person who has a child, taught their child how to program, their parent is a geek, we would have a large body that would be more statistically representative of the normal balance of male-female population.
Yeah. Even going back to some of my own experiences, it was my mom who actually got me into computer science in the first place. And I just remember the pure joy of just being given these books and these magazines and say, hey, let's follow along and let's do something. And I can only imagine, you know, bringing that bring that to your own kids and those kinds of shared experiences where it's there's no negativity. It's just joy. It's just exploration. It's amazing.
And well, so some friends of mine have talked about this before, and it's kind of why people got into programming or how programming has changed since we started. And it was interesting to us to note that when we started programming, a lot of the programmers, and there were more women, I think, were still just like us. They were kind of socially awkward. They were, you know, not the most attractive folk in the world, maybe, or they didn't think so. They were, you know, shy. They were kind of introverted. They, you know, got into their own little worlds. They were into sci-fi and yada, yada, yada. And in the past 15 years, it's gotten more diverse, let's say, and let's put some little air quotes around that. And I think it happened right around the time of the dot-com boom, where anyone suddenly could be a programmer, and anyone was. And so you got we called it the infusion of jocks. And suddenly programming became about chest thumping and, you know, proving that you're a better programmer than someone else. Whereas the old school, as I like to call it because I'm old, we used to just, you know, write code. And, and you know, if you were the biggest, baddest coder on the block, you'd have the biggest, baddest code.
Yeah,
and, but, you know, there wasn't a lot of dispute.
Yeah, it's actually an interesting observation. I was actually at an antique store, a year or so ago, and I was talking with a woman there who actually retired from the computer science industry, and she actually was one of the, you know, she claimed at least that she had worked in the in CS back in the 1960s and 1970s.
It wasn't Grace Hopper, was it?
No.
She's passed away.
Yeah. But it was more along the lines of it was seen as a community where if one person wins, everybody wins, because in the grand scheme of things, and they would have competitions between universities and organizations such as the Bell Labs of the world, where if one person succeeded, everyone succeeded because everyone saw the code and everyone joined in. There wasn't really a pedestal as much as there was a community all trying to kind of grasp what's going on.
You know, Chris, that reminds me, Chris, of what you spoke about in your End of Negativity talk, where you started out by saying Dart is great, CoffeeScript is great. Like, you're at JSConf and you're like saying, hey, anything is, you know, like, new languages, bring them, because they're going to enhance our language. If they're good, they're good for all of us. Like, you know.
Yeah. I mean, speaking especially after the discussion about difference between old school, new school, it's interesting because if you look, like, the 70s and early 80s were so vibrant with different new crazy ideas. I mean, TCP/IP, IP itself, DARPANET, the mouse, the GUI interface, Unix. I could list for everything that is fundamental to the way we live now. If you think about the last 10 years, have we really been pushing the envelope, or have we just been making things that make ourselves feel good? And it's a concern I have that we're moving towards a feel-good society. And part of that leads into the whole negativity. You know, if I want to feel good and you look like you're feeling good, I'm going to try to tear you down because I'm not feeling as good. So that way you're feeling as bad as I am. But more importantly, and specific to your point, Dart, people were going off the hook saying Dart is going to destroy the internet before any single line of code or any syntax was published. It's insane. Now the week after that, before the video was posted, of course it was published. And you know, Dart has some cool things. It has isolates, which are coming into Node.js as well. There are different, you know, things and ideas that are in there. It's an interesting thing. And I think that everyone should try their best to make a new language, because you learn a lot about the languages you use if you try to build your own language. CoffeeScript is great. You know, more people are using JavaScript because of CoffeeScript. So if you're a JavaScript purist and you hate CoffeeScript, you're doing it all wrong. It's not about making the purest code. It's about bringing people into the community and making sure that they can perform their tasks in a way that works well for them. It has nothing to do with what you think is right. It has everything to do with how many people can code properly the best. If CoffeeScript works for you, great. If Ruby, great. If Python, great. There was a great project at EU that's actually been around for quite a while called EM Scripting, which takes sort of the LLVM concept and utilizes JavaScript as the backend bytecode system. It truly getting to the point of JavaScript becoming the assembly of the modern era, and specifically the web. So you could take a language like Python, run it through EM Scripting or run it on EM Scripting and run it in a browser. And you can do that with Perl and Lisp and some Lisps and all these other things. Much like you would do with JRuby and stuff of that nature, which runs on the JVM, or IronRuby, which runs on .NET. So it's one of these things where there's no need to stymie or prevent new languages or new ideas. If anything, we should encourage them. And, you know, as I mentioned in the talk, and as you mentioned as well in the lead-in, it's only good for the web. If it was released and it was great and it was so much better than JavaScript, then hell, it's so much better than JavaScript. I have to use it in my day-to-day. I feel better as a developer using it. It's so amazing. It makes me warm and fuzzy on the inside. If it's less than that, then and JavaScript's better, or some other language, Language X is better, then I'm going to continue using Language X because I know it. And I'll probably pull in some of those cool ideas, and, you know, maybe it'll merge up. A lot of people have a lot of, especially in the JavaScript community, have a lot of angst against Adobe for Flash. Darn Flash everywhere. But what they don't realize is that all the JIT compilation wouldn't have existed without Adobe writing ActionScript, putting a JIT in ActionScript, which is similar to JavaScript, and then open sourcing that. The Tamarin releases. People sort of forget these things in our historical record, in part because we have the attention span of something that has a short attention span. Hacker News. Yeah. Out of a post on Hacker News. Yeah. And so we need to, you know, realize that not everyone's evil and not everything's evil. And a lot of people are just trying to do good and just keep making amazing things. It pains me to see all these startups doing things that and getting pimped for doing things that aren't really pushing us forward. They might make money, they might do amazing things, but are they really pushing the art forward? And we don't have a Xerox PARC anymore, and we don't have research, and academia isn't moving at the speed of the web. And we need to get back to this point. We need to push it all forward. That's my argument.
Well, so we were talking about problems in modern programming at lunch yesterday, and we kind of talked about framework-itis, where people start writing a framework before they have a problem to solve, kind of. And, you know, I said, yeah, we didn't really see that happening back in the old days. And I said, oh, but everyone just wrote their own language. Hey, we need a common object business-oriented language. Okay, let's make that. Hey, we need something to do math. Let's call it Mathematica. We'll do that. And so nowadays, we're kind of starting to go back to that, where everyone is writing a compiler for everything. And I'm kind of wondering if... And I don't think this is necessarily the case with CoffeeScript, but I wonder at what point there's greater dividends to be had by working to fix or extend the language versus writing your own, or, you know, writing another layer of abstraction on top of that language.
That's tricky, though, because in this case, JavaScript is an interesting language because it's shipped on a lot of different browsers.
It's everywhere.
Yeah.
Yes.
So CoffeeScript.
Android.
Yeah, right. So CoffeeScript fixes a problem that, like, if you want to extend the JavaScript language, that's not an easy thing to do, you know, because you need to convince a bunch of different browser vendors and a bunch of other people that they need to implement that. And so I think the idea with CoffeeScript, I saw an interesting. I'm sure you guys saw the Regenwald thing where he said CoffeeScript isn't a language worth learning, but then he ends up the post by saying it's basically JavaScript, the good parts, you know, codified into a language. And so, you know, the idea being that it's taking all the best practices of JavaScript, you know, debatably, of course, but and putting them into a language. And, you know, so the idea that I'm seeing out of that is, like, it's very difficult and it takes forever to get JavaScript updated and across all the platforms, but shipping a new language that just down... I mean, that's essentially what jQuery is, right?
I disagree with that, kind of. But first, I'd made the remark that I think CoffeeScript is more like Pigeon JavaScript. It's him go take the closure and go down to the beach, huh? and with most languages, I would agree with you that it's, you know, and it is hard to extend JavaScript, the language itself, in terms of the spec. But the beauty of JavaScript is that you can supplement any object's prototype with new methods, overwrite existing methods. And yeah, I mean, there's arguments for and against that. It's a bad practice. It surprises developers if you start replacing toString with your own implementations and stuff like that. But it's relatively simple and painless to make JavaScript into whatever you want. I spent a lot of time implementing cross-browser methods like inner HTML and inner text, just writing JavaScript so that I just have to write inner text anywhere else in my page, and I would, if it was there, fine. If the browser supported it in its JavaScript implementation, that was great. If not, I supplemented it.
That's the ability to override everything. That's sort of that beauty of the language and elegance of the language that you don't get until you actually get deep into it. And a lot of people, you know, they don't go for the deep tour. They try to update the DOM and it breaks in a certain browser with two letters. And they curse the world and hate JavaScript.
Then they make a class called class.
Right.
A function called class and have it have methods and super and whatnot.
Yeah. So there's, I mean, it's a great language. As I think you were alluding to, it's a great language because of the things you can do with it. And that's not limited to not creating a new language on top of it. CoffeeScript is great. ClojureScript is another one that's really cool. It takes the syntax of Clojure and puts it on top of a JSVM. Interesting concept, you know, writing Lisp to do web page updates. That's pretty daggone cool for a certain group of people. Lisp is unfortunately not going to become wildly popular. Everyone's not going to stop writing 00C style syntax and go, Lisp is the way, the path, the light, all at once. They might someday, but not probably in the next year. I could be completely wrong with that, but I'm kind of confident Lisp won't dominate the world in the next year. But it is cool that people can have these new languages and use it on top of JavaScript. As in reference to moving the language forward with IE moving to a more aggressive upgrade path process, and Mozilla already on that and Chrome already on that, you know, velocity of change is going to be higher than it ever has been. It's interesting, and whenever I talk to people about JavaScript, they always have almost a 10-year-ago conception of what the world looks like. Most people, when you talk about JavaScript right now, they think of the world at best at an IE6 level, but most likely at an IE4 level. They think about all the dirty syntax they'd have to write, the polyfills that they'd have to write. That if you look at the modern browserscape, that being anything written in the last 3 years, you don't have to write all those things. They're all readily there. They're all fast. It's all great. At some point, we as a community of developers need to just say, hey, if the browser is older than 3 years, I don't care about it. And I know I'm going to get a lot of people who don't like that idea. But I mean, if browsers are updating every 6 months and you're now at Chrome 52 and Firefox, what would that be at that point? 41? You got to draw the line somewhere and just say, I'm not going to support Firefox 8 because I'm on Firefox 51. There just has to be a line in the sand. And once you have higher velocity change, no one's going to remember the difference between one to the next, to the next, to the next. So you always, hopefully it pushes us all to move forward. The only reason why we had to care about IE6 is because IE6 stayed around for 10 years. And now that Microsoft's back in the game, hooray! Kicking tail, JavaScript in the OS level, doing all sorts of amazing things. I mean, Windows, the next Windows 8 is beautiful from a JavaScript developer's perspective. It's the first time I've ever strongly considered in the longest of time of buying a Windows machine. And that's coming from a person who loves Unix quite much so. But it's a awesome, exciting world. There's innovation, there's energy, there's excitement there. The browsers are getting updated. The engines are getting updated. The engines are being used in unique ways that you're not seeing elsewhere. There's all sorts of really, really cool things going on in the way of the web. And we've just scratched the surface. We still have 99% of the people still think JavaScript is that slow, ugly beast that's horrible syntax. And it hurt me because its truthiness is not always truthy.
Yes, and I littered my HTML with on-click events and on-mouse overs and such.
Oh, let's talk. So one of the other ways, going way back in the conversation to improving positivity, David Flanagan, the guy who wrote JavaScript, the definitive guide, if you've bought a book for JavaScript and you could drop it on your foot and it would break your foot, it's probably his book. It's the big O'Reilly book with the rhino on it that has sort of taken off. He started a thing called Team.js, which is by no means limited to just JS developers. It's open to everybody, and we encourage everyone to do it, to enter into Mozilla's Firefox Challenge, which is an event that they just started this year that they want to, you know, bring everyone together around the holiday season and do some good for the world. So what they've ponied up is they contacted a whole bunch of celebs, big names, Edward Norton, a whole bunch of other people that are on the TVs and such. And they said, we'll give you $5,000 to your celebrity charity, and whoever out of you can raise the most amount of money by January 11th, we'll get an extra $25,000 to that charity. So these celebs don't need money. They have enough money as it is, but they're at least trying to do something good and use their fame and publicity to raise money for charity. So good on them. But back to David. David got the idea that he wants to enter in and see if geeks can beat out celebs. And he didn't get the $5,000 bootstrap. But to this date, we've been able to raise $13,326 for the Feeding America program, which for every US dollar provided, if you're in Europe, that's probably like $4 per euro at this point. But every US dollar provided is 8 meals that feed the hungry and needy people in America. If you are listening to this and you can spare a couple bucks even, please go to crowdrise.com, and right across the top, there's a huge banner about it. You'll see the big awesome JS logo that we published out and pushed out during JSConf. It's yellow. It's got just the text JS. You'll be able to spot it. Don't worry. It's the only one without a shining happy face of a celebrity you probably know. And we went from non-existent and having $50 in the bank to having $13,000 in, I think it was a whole day. I think we had 24 hours when we got behind it. Everyone got behind it and pushed. And we went from the bottom of the list to the top of the list. And we've held on to the top spot until about Monday. And Edward Norton, he took the top away from us. And I think that, and some other guy took the next spot away from us. David Cook. I don't know who he is. That's not David Cook. Who's that celebrity for him? David Cook is the guy who started it, the signed copies of This Loud Mouth. It's, I think, one of the like late night talk show guys. Anyways, neither here nor there. We don't care about them. We care about geeks. It's geeks beating up celebs, and I think that's an awesome cause. And if you can spare a couple bucks and help us out, that'd be great. All the money goes directly to charity, so I'm not getting any benefit out of this. I just think it'd be awesome to see Team.js at the number one spot and dominate all these celebs. It would be really, really cool.
Excellent. Going back to something else that you said at your recent talk, you kind of ended up with, what would you do if you knew you could not fail?
Yeah, it's a plaque I actually have on my desk. I'm looking at it right now. The exact quote is, what would you attempt to do if you knew you could not fail? I've personally tried to live my life around that, especially the older that I get. I say older because I'm not sure I'm getting any wiser, but definitely older. And it, you know, the world is always there to tell you that you're going to fail, you're not going to succeed, especially as we mentioned in the development world. And I've pulled off some crazy things that I don't think should happen. Last year we did 7 conferences in a year while running a company that we just had a big event for and signed contracts and company being a startup and, you know, raising a child and all these other sorts of things. So I try to go crazy and just don't let the fear of failure paralyze me. And so I tried to take that message of do it, just attempt it. The worst that could happen is you could fail and just run with it and see how far it can roll. You know, it's a cool sort of thing, and I wanted to pass it out to to whoever might listen.
You know, and it's funny as I'm reading that because there are so many things that I haven't done because I was afraid of failure. And by not doing them, I failed. As I look back over the years, I mean, some of them other people have done and others were just lost opportunities. But and where other people filled in where I should have, that's great. But others were just lost opportunities because I was afraid of failure, So, I mean, the fear of failure versus not doing something kind of pales when you look at it that way, where not doing something is probably, it's just not going to happen.
You fail at 100% of the tasks you don't attempt.
Exactly. Yep. Well, I was thinking of going to one of the 10 million Elijah Manor questions.
He won. He
blew us out of the water. So, okay, let me go through a few that you haven't answered yet. First of all, Twitter question from Elijah Manor. Chris recently tweeted that he thought the trolls may be right. Right about what?
So this one is, one of those things that anytime you attempt something, you sometimes question if the other side's right. Like I said, there's a grain of truth in every bit of the negativity comments, and it's finding that grain. Node.js has had a meteoric rise, and recently, there's the potential for people being over their skis and being overexcited about it. And that's not always a bad thing, but it's also not always a good thing. And you start seeing that happen and people get so giddy and excited. And, at some point, if you're standing back as like a bystander, I mean, I'm not actively involved in the Node.js community per se. I have a couple critical projects out there, and I'm building my entire company on it. But sitting back as an observer, sometimes, and not going to name any names or any specific groups, and it's not really any specific group, it's just a general feeling that maybe some of the negative comments were right, and maybe some of the negative pieces are right, and they were pointing out issues that I didn't see at the point that they wrote it, but maybe I now see it. It's not necessarily a question of may they be right or may they be wrong. It's once you realize where their grain of truth or grains of truth, as it might be, are, how can I go and fix the problem or attempt to fix it? So that's sort of one of the things I've been trying to figure out is how can I fix that, specifically for the Node.js community, because I think it's a good group of people who are trying to do the right things. And I don't think the trolls who are out there against them, I think they make more noise sometimes than the people that they think that they're fighting against. And that doesn't always make sense to me, but it does. Sometimes the negative loud voice is a lot louder than the positive quiet voice.
There's a lot of hype around it. I've even heard of some people quitting their jobs and buying MacBook Airs.
And it's crazy. Nobody's doing that.
It's always funny when you run into somebody that you were just talking about. No, I mean, there is hype around it, but there's also, I would say, equal, if not greater, negative hype or hate about this this fake hype going on at the same time. And that actually encourages the hype. So it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. If I go around saying the hype around Node.js is so high and there isn't, it's like the bear in the woods. I don't know if you guys know this adage, but somebody, you live happily in a suburban neighborhood and your neighbor goes, have you seen the bear? And you haven't seen a bear. And all of a sudden you see the bear everywhere and you have no idea how a bear got there and you get in your car and run away. But it's, I think that the Node.js hype, for better or worse, is a bear. It's not there unless you think it's there or try to find it. And then once you find it, you see it everywhere.
Now that Node is on Windows, it's kind of jumped the shark. So I've moved on to Bails, which is Rails on Bash.
Oh, yeah. I hear shell script is what we're going to rewrite everything into. GitHub Hubot, Fibonacci sequences, shell scripts.
And I'm already preparing for Bails to be overhyped. So I'm moving on to Sails, which is self on Rails.
I heard Mathematica is really where it's at, because then Fibonacci is just like, it flies.
Seriously, I mean, we're kidding ourselves with all these closures and functions and syntax and whatnot. It's all numbers.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, Node is experiencing popularity. It's all in your definition of hype. If your definition of hype is running out and buying MacBook Airs, I would say the hype's about to rapidly change, especially with Windows and Microsoft releasing Node.js on Azure and all the really cool stuff that's going on with the Windows 8 at having JavaScript as sort of a first-class language to do client-side programming. I mean, I think there's... I don't think... If you call that hype, I would contend to you, sir, you have not seen anything yet. I think that the world's about to get even better.
So Chris, I'm curious about that. Like, I work for Microsoft because I generally like the stuff they do. But I'm curious, as somebody who's not in that world, how that feels. I mean, you sound reasonably happy about, you know, JavaScript and Windows 8, about Microsoft being part of Node.js. I mean, does there get to be a feeling of like Microsoft is jumping in too hard or messing things up? Or does it feel kind of like this is good and they're getting involved and that's a good thing? I mean, is there a little of both?
I can only give you my perspective. So I just want to preface that. I'm not speaking for a broader audience. I get the feeling that there's the initial shock, and I've talked to a lot of people about this. There's the initial shock of, oh my God, Microsoft's in there. And then they come to realize a couple things. One, Microsoft now isn't the Microsoft that the Unix people or the people who all carry MacBook Airs, the stigma that they have. It's a different company. It's grown, it's matured, it's realized it's done some things and has grown better for it and made changes. I mean, you see that with Windows 7 that's already out there, the difference between it and XP and that whole fun things. And you see it with Windows 8 going a little bit further. You see it with Metro, which is a beautiful, beautiful user interface. And Xbox. I mean, Microsoft, from the outsider's perspective, is doing cool things. Now, the question is can they get past being Microsoft and let themselves become Microsoft, if that makes any sense? Microsoft's always had this problem of keeping things too guarded or too tight in a world that everything's free and open and happy. And in part, that's good business. And in part, that's also an older way of working. You look at a lot of the projects, and this is one of the cool things I've noticed. If you were to, and I'm not going to say it, but if you were to search on a hub of Gits for various different Microsoft things, you would find out that there's actually a lot of open sourced Microsoft projects. They may not be publicly known, but they are on the hub of Gits. If you don't know what that is, you figure it out. That's my obfuscation for this day. And so they're doing a lot of open source work. They're doing a lot of amazing things. The work with Azure for Node.js. I think as long as Microsoft doesn't become Microsoft of old, Microsoft new has a fighting chance of being one amazing development target and a development friendly world again, if not for the first time, for a group of people.
Yeah. Well, and it's not just open source devs that have projects on the hub of Gits either. It's actual Microsoft projects.
Microsoft employees, yeah. And it's the conference, at JSConf U, the talk I loved the most was actually by a Microsoft employee, but you didn't see the Microsoft logo on any slides. You didn't see really any hints about it. And that's sort of like, that's the key. If you look at Google at a presentation right now, Google slapped everywhere as if somebody doesn't know who Google is. At every presentation they give, they have the same Google boilerplate and they're giving the same slides, same Google stuff on it. And at some point at a conference, I'm like, I don't want to see that anymore. I'm not here to see Google. I'm here to see Alex Russell. And who does work for Google, just to clarify. Whereas with the talk at EU, which was talking about how, you know, getting Node to run on IIS or run in IIS and the cool things that you can do with the different levels of isolation and encapsulation and compartmentalization, and how that would improve cost efficiencies and ratios and all these cool things that are just like developer giddy happy moments. And you're not being slapped in the face with the Microsoft logo. It's just sort of at the end, you're like, oh, wow, that was a Microsoft talk, and it wasn't a Microsoft talk. I think that's the next fundamental shift that has to be permeated across the board.
Yeah, it was interesting. So Tomek Yanchuk was the guy who's behind that, who is behind IIS Node. And yeah, the point of this talk was really nothing about anything that we've done in particular in the company. This is more along the lines of, how do we take serving serving of Node.js applications and bring down the cost to almost absolutely nothing through condensing or increasing the density. So Tomek has a project out there, Denser, and that's what he showed off there, taking it down down to the V8 isolate level of Node, and showing off a lot of those kind of cool things that you could do. But I think one of the highlights of that talk was the fact that I think it was Eric Corey, who is on the V8 team, was going back and forth with Tomek, and I think that was a really invaluable exchange of information. Basically, both companies just looking at, and just more to the point, individuals looking at how to make the development experience better, how to make it cheaper, how to make it more accessible was actually very, very interesting.
Matt, can you talk a little bit more about what you mean by density with regard?
Yeah, so what we mean by density is how many applications can you get on a particular server? How many can you get it on a particular thread? Kind of that sort of thing. You know, JavaScript is a funny little beast in that there is really no such thing as threading per se. That how do you get a maximum amount of web applications or server-side applications to reside on the same machine using the same runtime, and even further granular down to the thread or isolate level, how can you isolate a particular application from another, but yet increasing the number of applications that you can serve up from a single machine? So you're literally bringing down the cost of hosting down from, you know, five euros a month down to five euro cents a month. That was the basic gist of it.
Okay.
So it was very different than some of the talks that we've done at JS Comps in the past, and I think it was a lot neater in terms of a real technical exchange with the community.
So one of the things I wanted to make sure, when we talked to you last, both of you guys, I came away learning quite a bit. And I think this was one of the first mentions that I'd heard of CoffeeScript, of CommonJS, of quite a lot of stuff that was probably old to you, but new to me. And so I'm wondering if you can kind of, you know, mention any of the things that over the past year or things that are kind of emerging trends in the JavaScript world.
Well, I think Chris actually hit on one of them earlier, which was the EMScripten. That was from one of the folks at Mozilla who came up with the idea of having a LLVM interpreter in JavaScript. So they actually had some demos of H.264 decoding in pure JavaScript. They had a lot of other really, really interesting things, such as audio through JSMAD and so forth, that are particularly very interesting. It's all kind of boiling down to Atwood's law of if it can be written in JavaScript, it will be written in JavaScript, or something to that effect. To me, that was a very, very interesting set of talks. Is where else can JavaScript go? So early in the JS Conf lore, and I don't want to take away from Chris's thunder at all, but we started off with more browser based. But as time has gone along, actually that's not true, because I guess early JS Conf also focused on AppCelerator and stuff like that. But It's definitely transcended a lot of bounds in terms of who would have thought that a lot of these technologies you could just do in plain JavaScript, a little brain dead language that people just littered everywhere in their HTML, versus being seen as a true language. So those kinds of things, the MP3 decoding, the video decoding. And then you see such projects that the partnership with Mozilla and Intel and RiverTrail. You definitely see JavaScript going in many, many different directions, and not just on the server and not just on the client, but kind of a full stack development now.
Now, you mentioned RiverTrail. Can you speak a little bit more about that?
Yeah, RiverTrail. That was a partnership between Mozilla and Intel, and the idea behind that was to allow for parallel computations in JavaScript. So think for the .NET developer, think of P-Link, or parallel link in JavaScript, and that was a lot of the intention behind that.
As you're talking about all these things, I keep having to correct my brain because I hear about decoding this, decoding that, doing parallel this, whatever, in JavaScript. And my brain keeps telling me, oh, that's too slow. JavaScript can't do that. And I have to just correct myself because, yes, obviously it can. Like, we're seeing JavaScript do all kinds of amazing real-time computation, but it's a difficult thing. I wonder, like, for me as an old guy, it's something I'm gonna have to keep just telling my brain that. But I wonder, as people grow up with this, there maybe it's just not, you know, maybe it's an old guy thing, and maybe younger people.
Well, you know, if you put C sharp or C++ on top of a brain dead runtime with a inefficient mark and sweep garbage collector, it's gonna run slow too. But you start actually looking at the infrastructure that JavaScript is running on, you say, okay, there's nothing wrong with the language, because, come on, it's just text. It's like Scheme. We know Scheme isn't slow in and of itself. Syntactically, it can't be, because, like I said, it's just text. It's just words. So let's beef up the stuff underneath it. And as they start to do more and more of that, then you see, oh, hey, look, it's not so slow anymore. You look at V8. And you actually, what I thought was interesting when we interviewed Paul Betts about the Coffee and SAS compiler was he ended up embedding V8 in there because it was so incredibly more, much better, faster than anything that was written on the CLR that parsed JavaScript.
Right.
He was like, oh, you know, when I was using the IronJS or I forget what the other one is, Jurassic. He was like, ah, you know, this, it was too slow and it was causing timeouts. And then I just went ahead and bit the bullet and put V8 in there, and boom, it's like, I don't care if it's inefficient to do it that way. It doesn't take any time at all.
Exactly. That's what he said, was like, I have to jump through tons of hoops and there's other inefficiencies, but it doesn't matter because it's so damn fast. It all works out. Yeah.
Yeah, I would easily contend with all the attention that has been paid to JavaScript for a language that people tend to look down their noses upon sometimes. It is amazingly fast, and there are a lot of companies that are spending a lot of money and a lot of effort on making it as fast and efficient as possible through jetting and so forth.
So, Chris, were there any things that came out at JSConf that were, I mean, are there any big trends that you're seeing coming up?
Matt sort of mentioned this earlier, but if you can write it in JavaScript, people are. And we're actually at a point now where people actually are. The recent one was an MP3 decoder written entirely in JavaScript, and you have the Linux shell ported over into JavaScript. You have Node. You have one of the big things at JSConfU was DynJS, which is almost 100% invoked dynamic JavaScript implementation. So running on the JVM, think Rhino, but lightning fast, as opposed to Rhino slow. And so what the thing that I noticed the most is that we're reaching a point where there are no boundaries. For a language that has always been considered a bounded language, it's stuck in the browser. Still to this day, you know, people think of it as it's only good for browser. We only use it because it's in the browser. But as these things start moving out, I wouldn't be surprised if you see in the near future entire OS is built. But first step would be something that I know certain browser vendors are working on is rewriting the entire plugin system to be JavaScript only. So like PDFJS is a perfect example. Instead of having to open up the Adobe PDF Reader or Renderer plugin, you could render that PDF directly in the browser using JavaScript and using the native ability of Canvas and SVG to create essentially the PDF in the browser. So that way you get all the benefits that you normally have in the browser, the native find, the selection, the copy, the paste, without having to go through this plugin componentry. If you had a browser that was only JavaScript and no plugins, the world could be pretty cool. There's H.264 decoders already written in JavaScript, which means you could run all of YouTube without invoking a single plugin. There's all these neat things that now are fallouts that are even possible and, more importantly, being built. And that's sort of the cool thing that I'm seeing pop up at this point in the trajectory. And it's only a matter of time before that moves out of the browser and moves down into the backend systems. And you could write an entire operating system in, you know, writing out to the serial ports and the different pieces and all in JavaScript. So I don't think JavaScript is the one and only pure language is a great idea. I don't think even a portion of that is a great idea, but I think it's interesting to see the world evolving towards this point where people aren't afraid to try putting JavaScript in there.
You know, that just keeps bringing me back to, like, Mozilla was really onto something with Zool, I think, because it was JavaScript, CSS, HTML, and it pushed everything that Firefox supported, which at the time was way ahead of the curve with SVG and stuff, before everyone else was doing that stuff. And it's true, like, their plugin system jumped ahead because it was HTML, CSS, JavaScript, zipped up. Like, that's a nice delivery mechanism, you know? And so, as you're saying there's no reason as JavaScript runtime gets incredibly fast and more, and Atwood's law continues to advance, like, It's a great platform for building just about anything on. And I was thinking earlier as we were talking about JavaScript as a language and what it can do and browser support and all that, but I think about, like, Git. People say that Git is a language for writing source control upon, you know, like, Git is a little bit complex, but it supports so much that you can write your own version control on top of it. And JavaScript comes across as a scripting language, but really is so extensible. You can write other languages on it. You can extend upon it infinitely. And it's a great delivery mechanism for just about anything.
Yeah, there was another interesting project from I think it was another Mozilla guy who actually did JSIL, which was to take random IL and recompile it into straight up JavaScript. It might not be the most idiomatic or beautiful JavaScript, but it certainly shows the promise of the platform to say that that one way of thinking about things through IL can easily be translated into native JavaScript.
That would be Kevin Gadd.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, that's kind of the idea behind LLVM, right? So everything gets compiled down to LLVM bytecode, and then you can translate it to something else, right?
Yep, exactly. And there was an earlier project, of course, from Microsoft that I happened to be somewhat involved with, which was Volta, which kind of was trying to do the same thing, which was to say, I can take one set of code and multi-target it anywhere.
Hmm. Right.
Yeah, and there was going to be a... There was a, I think this was more of a VM though, the Parrot from, I think it was Perl?
Perl. Yeah, yeah. That's Perl.
Yeah, that was going to be more of a universal VM, kind of like the JVM or the CLR or things like that. But it was another interesting idea.
And it was going to change the world.
And as soon as they ship Perl 6 or 7, it will.
Yeah.
There's so many might have been things, you know, like I wonder, like I argued with people a long time ago about, like, what if Microsoft's Silverlight and all the XAML focus had been more SVG focused, you know, and it's, I mean, I don't know. We keep moving forward, I guess.
Sort of. I would say we keep spinning in circles. I mean,
well, we were arguing the other day that Node was making the Silverlight dream come true. You get to write in the same language on the server and the client.
It's also making the Java dream come true.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Java, JavaScript. Yeah, I see where you're going.
Yeah. Yeah, whenever I teach a course is to train people up, I sort of lead in with JavaScript and Java. The only actual relationship between the two is that JavaScript actually delivered what Java promised, in that you'd write once and it'd run everywhere. And so, yeah, I mean, it's I love that everyone's trying to sell VMs. It's like VMs are a dime a dozen right now. This is one of the big things that's going on in the ether of things. There's a whole battle because there's a fork of WebKit, which is the raw engine that runs in Safari on Apple Safari and Google Chrome. And the Google team has created a multi-VM system within the WebKit fork, and they're trying to get it pushed upstream so that way Safari would have it as well and adopt it into all the different WebKit-based browsers, including mobile browsers and stuff of that nature. they're doing it under the guise of support for Dart. It could be used for multiple different things with varying benefits and downsides. But if you want to know the biggest, hottest thing going on right now, that battle seems to be waging pretty hot. The white fires of it are going quite heatedly because it's an interesting point. If you had multi-VM support within a browser, is JavaScript the language that is everywhere? It's an interesting world. I don't know if it'll happen. There's too much problem with it. For me to write even tail call elimination and restartable conditions and dynamic dispatches in a language that only works in what is Chrome plus Safari now? Is that 41%? No, it's not even that. Let's say 35% of all the browsers. I'm still missing the rest of the world. And yes, you could say it has a degraded experience, but that's not going to work. So as long as we keep browser diversity, I would say that the world will be better served for that and for that contention than it is for the co-opetition, as Brendan Eich likes to say. The co-opetition is good for the common developer and even the uncommon developers. I think co-opetition is a good thing.
Back in the old day, that's the way the languages ran. They all had their own little VM, Smalltalk, COBOL, all that. So if you wanted to write any language, you'd first write your VM. And, it basically hauled it around with them, mm-hmm. the language did. So it kind of makes sense that I think instead of trying to include multiple VMs from the start, maybe they should just make VMs pluggable into the browser. So, you can install or embed whatever VM you want. Maybe there's even a new HTML element where you can specify a VM, you specify a URL where that VM can be gotten from.
That's a slippery slope, though, I'd say.
Well, yeah, because then the next thing you know, everyone's PayPal password is stolen. But
exactly. The one thing...
I get to write dancing hamster videos in whatever language I write, right?
Right. Right. The one thing that I think that every pundit for the multi-VM system misses is the JavaScript or the I hate JavaScript or JavaScript's ugly camp. The one thing that they miss, and maybe it's because of my darker past, is that JavaScript as a language has been beaten up, abused, taken into dark alleys, and had its money shaken out of it more so than any other language. In terms of battle conditions, you're not going to catch any language that's had been in the forefront of abuse from malicious attacks and malicious developers and, you know, buffer overflows and underruns and all these other wonderful things than JavaScript at this point. If you put a new language in the browser, I can assure you PayPal passwords will easily slip through. The security boundaries would just be so open. We had mentioned earlier that someone mentioned that one of the great things about JavaScript is you can override the definition of objects and all. And that's kind of true. I mean, one of the things that they've slipped in the past couple years is that you can't override the definition or instantiation of certain objects that have to be sane for the world to work. You can't override the initialization of array because of Google context.
Right. So the point being that JavaScript has gotten the hell beat out of it, and during that process, it has been battle hardened. Like, right. It's
more than you can ever really like codify. You can't say it's 99% battle tested. But what I know is JavaScript has been in that war zone, and Ruby, Perl, Python, C#, blah 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 blah, Dart haven't been. So, am I saying don't do multi-VM? I'm saying no, that's fine. Just hire a really, 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 really good security team, because I can tell you that's going to be the first alley for all sorts of new attack vectors.
Okay. Well, I'm glancing at the time, and we've been going for quite a while. So, and with you being on the East Coast, it's even later. Before we wrap up, I wanted to check two things. One is, have we covered, is there anything else new and interesting that it would be a travesty if we skipped over?
Not to my knowledge. Keep dreaming.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, the only other thing, I was just emphasizing, the work that we've done on Node, but I mean, other than that, I mean, that's really the long and short of it. You know, the conversations having gone back to, JSConf EU last year and me talking with Ryan and so forth and saying, you know, really this should be a priority. And then finally getting buy-in was great. To me that was a lot of fun.
Well, so I think that along those lines, the thing that people keep kind of missing about the Node support is it's not just, you know, hey, we rewrote some of the I/O stuff so that it doesn't, you know, crash on Windows. It's that they actually went the extra mile. So, I mean, being able to run it isolated in IIS is, you know, not anything I ever expected. I thought that if I got Node running, I'd just be running it and it would listen on a port and I'd just have to make sure that nothing else was sharing that port.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly that aspect to it. And if you look at our partnership that we have announced with Joyent, you'll notice that we actually have a core team member of Node that works for Microsoft, Igor Zinkovsky. And that's really interesting. To really put some sort of skin in the game, talk about libuv and a nice abstraction layer, and then, you know, work with the community to work on some tooling, to work on Azure deployment, I think is very interesting.
And that, Matt, as we talked about before, that's definitely enough that we should do another show on just that. Like,
absolutely. Absolutely.
So my other question was, is there anything coming up where Matt, you or Chris are speaking at in the near future, or, you know, obviously upcoming JSConfs, but, you know, other things that our listeners should know about?
Nobody lets me speak. I'm never allowed to speak. If you're into Node and you're on the business side, there's Node Summit. If you're technical, they're kind of discouraging technical people from attending. It's really geared to be more business focused. There will be a JSConf in April somewhere, hopefully. Hopefully in April. Otherwise, I'm going to be awfully upset with myself. And that's about all I know of at this point. Matt, do you know of any?
No, I mean, that's long and short of it, as far as I know. Nothing really upcoming. It's kind of the slow season. I know Glenn is off to CodeMash doing a Node on Azure talk, but that's about it.
Okay, anything else we should talk about before we wrap up here?
I got nothing.
I have a Finnish beer, and that's good enough for me.
This is
Finnish as in completed, or Finnish as in the country? Finland.
No, it's just a dogfish head. So,
that's not
Antonio.
Finished at all.
No.
So really you have a fishish beer.
Nice.
Chris, last time we talked to you, you had some recommendations on beer. Do you have any favorites lately?
Yeah. Starhill, which is actually out of Charlottesville, Virginia here on the East Coast. They have a really amazing pumpkin porter I just had today, which is, kind of kicking myself because the pumpkin beer season is far since past, but it was amazing. In terms of the winter ones, there's a gingerbread ale out of Bison, which is out of California. It's organic. It's absolutely amazing. Think gingerbread cookies and the warmth and happiness of them, and 10% alcohol. Hooray! the other thing would be 21st Amendments. Fireside Chat, which is really good. It's a winter ale that's got spices in it, as most beers now during the winter time do have spices. Make sure to drink it relatively cold, if not cool. Once it starts to warm up, those spices get out and not as good. But those would be my recommended selection for the holiday season. And that goes well past December. You could do that up until about February and then switch over to some love beers. I don't know what those are, but I'm just going to lead with that.
Well, spring doesn't really have any good beers, though.
Oh, what are you talking about?
Oh, come on.
It's not the best season, but it
no,
has
it's
good
not.
Beers.
It's one it of the worst seasons for beer.
Unfiltered wheats.
Or Springbok.
What's the one with the goat? The plastic goat on the bottle.
Oh, God, that one? Yeah.
There's Doppels. Doppels are big during that season.
Yeah. Well, the ones that they made for Lent specifically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Doppelweizens, they're awesome.
Now, I'm noticing a little bit too much negativity springing up on this point.
It's all me. I'm sorry.
okay. We should probably wrap up at this point. So thanks a bunch, guys.
Thank you. Thanks. It was a pleasure.
All right. Well, hopefully we'll catch up with you a little bit sooner than like a year and a half or whatever it was. So
awesome. Right. That sounds good.
All right. That's all the time we have this week on Herding Code. Catch us next week.